Now, on Monday, I did an introductory lecture on weapons of mass destruction, where I looked at nuclear, chemical and biological weapons. Today, I'm doing a case study on North Korea. Now, as you probably know, North Korea is my primary research interest. So no notes for me today. I'm just going to talk off the cuff. Many of the graphics and pictures that I'm going to show you are from trips that I've done to the DPRK, including this one. Does anyone know where that square is? You should. It's on the news every time there's a North Korea story. But usually it's filled with people and goose-stepping soldiers and missiles on mobile launchers driving along that road. As you can see, that bus there is not nearly as impressive as a mobile missile launcher, and it's devoid of people. But this is Kim Il-sung Square in Pyongyang, overlooking the Taedong River and the Juche Tower in the background. All right, let's get into it. I gather most of you are familiar with the Kim Jong-il of the movie Team America. Now, this movie and this image is emblematic of sort of the mainstream perspective on North Korea that posits the North Korean leadership as a bit crazy. It posits their actions as irrational, or posits the behaviour of the state and the things that the government does as evil. Is this an accurate portrayal of the North Korean government? What do you think? I'll take that as a no. Like many things in the mainstream media, this view is incorrect. The problem with designating the leader and the leadership of a country as crazy is that it suggests that there's nothing about their behaviour that is worthy of deeper analysis. It suggests that their behaviour can't be explained by any deeper factors. They're crazy, they just do it because they're crazy. If you designate the leader and the leadership of another country as evil, how do you respond to evil? What's the way that you respond to someone that's evil? Yep, you fight against it. In international relations, that usually means you have to step up with military force. Now, in the Korean Peninsula, it's not possible for a whole host of strategic reasons for the surrounding countries to respond to North Korea with military force. So using the language of evil to describe them is not helpful because you can't respond in the way that you should. Now, this doesn't mean that the North Korean government doesn't do bad things. Yes, they do. But their actions and their behaviours and their policies can be explained by a whole host of factors, just like the actions and behaviours of any other state can be. And I'm going to try and delve into these reasons in relation to their nuclear posture today. So, just to broadly introduce the things I'm going to talk about, there's five main motivations for North Korea's nuclear weapons proliferation that I want to introduce to you. One is strategic. So there's a strategic rationale of why North Korea might want nuclear weapons. But there's also diplomatic reasons, economic reasons, domestic political reasons, and reasons due to sunk costs of prior investment. These are reasons why North Korea wants to maintain their nuclear program and are unlikely to give it up. So let's explore. And the central question is this: why would North Korea want nuclear weapons? Any ideas? Yep, yep. Why the US? Yep, and why China? China's meant to be their ally, but you're right. Sorry?
Just in case it's sort of a safeguard that we have them so don't hurt us as well.
Yeah. I would say not so much don't hurt us, but back off, don't interfere. We might be your little brother, but we want to be independent, run our own show. So two very good points there. The strategic argument. What do you notice about North Korea in this graphic and about the countries around them? Friendly, unfriendly, yeah?
Well, it's surrounded by some nuclear powers, with Russia and China. So.
Yep, and the United States has nuclear weapons positioned in Japan. It did have some in South Korea until the early 90s. But South Korea and Japan are also under the American nuclear umbrella. Everywhere is under the American nuclear umbrella, pretty much. What else? What about the relative size of all of these powers? Yeah, these are all generally great powers. Countries that have much more power in the international system than North Korea does. So North Korea is a small country, relatively underdeveloped, at least since the 1990s. Ordinarily, it wouldn't have as much clout as the countries surrounding it. So nuclear weapons helps to even the score. There's also historic reasons. Now, these images, quite dramatic images, come from the Korean War. So when was the Korean War, for those who know your history? 1950 to 53. Is it finished? No, it's not. So in 1953, there was an armistice signed between the United States and North Korea and China. There was no peace treaty that came out of that. So technically, the countries are still at war, and there was no agreement ending hostilities signed between the North and the South, which is very important. So even today, we're still in a technical state of war on the Korean Peninsula. But what you saw in this conflict, it was a very brutal conflict. There were 3 million people died, including at least 2 million civilians. There are atrocities committed by soldiers from North and South Korea, and possibly the Americans, as we discovered in Monday's lecture. There were population movements back and forth on the peninsula as the war ebbed and flowed. And after 3 years of this brutality, they roughly ended up in the same place as where they started. Now, does anyone know why North Korea is divided at the 38th parallel? Okay, this is a good little history lesson here. The very end of the Pacific War in 1945, the Soviet Union, now that it's been freed up from the war in Europe, which ended in the previous April, declares war on Japan and sends forces down through Manchuria from Siberia and into the northern Korean peninsula. The Americans, who are almost finished conquering Japan, see this manoeuvre and say, we can't afford to have communist Russian forces all the way down the Korean peninsula threatening the post-war Japan that we're wishing to create. So it's been suggested that one of the rationales for dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was to end the war against Japan so that the Americans could stop the Russians from taking all of Korea. Now, that's by no means the only reason, and there's clear other reasons why the atomic bombs were dropped. But you have to look at that in the context of this budding competition between the Soviet Union and the United States. This is the beginnings of the Cold War. Now, the division of the peninsula was put in place by an American military officer. I can't remember his name exactly. But he was thinking, how do we impose a division here, a division of responsibility between the Soviets and the Russians? And he said, right, look at the map, 38th parallel, we'll put the line there. It was arbitrary as that. No thought given to the conditions on the ground or the needs of the people. So that's where the 38th parallel division comes from, and because of that arbitrary act, we're stuck with a political division that exists today. But as far as North Korean strategy goes, they have long memories. They remember the brutality of this war. They also remember this man, and this is General Douglas MacArthur, who led the United Nations force in the Korean War and led the Incheon Landing, which turned the tide back from a North Korean victory. Now, apart from showing that aviator sunglasses are eternally cool, MacArthur famously said that he would like to used 26 atomic bombs to lay a strip of cobalt, as he called it, along the Yalu River and Chuman River frontiers between North Korea and China, so that Chinese forces wouldn't be able to intervene in the Korean conflict. Now, President Truman thought that was nuts, fortunately, and MacArthur ended up being removed from command, and that was the end of his military career because of he was demonstrating some megalomaniacal tendencies, including 26 atomic bombs. You can only imagine what that would have done to that region. But this is emblematic of 50 years subsequent of nuclear threats that the Americans have been posing against North Korea. So if you're a small country being threatened by a superpower with nuclear weapons, it would make sense strategically that you might want to develop nuclear weapons of your own. And the fact that it took them until the mid-1980s to start to get serious about this is quite surprising, given that the threats existed all the way back to the Korean War. And when we talk about America's nuclear threat, if you like, to North Korea, this is what it looks like. All of the kinds of nuclear delivery systems that I discussed in Monday's lecture, these are the types of weapons that can and are being targeted at the North. Okay. Now, I discussed the concept of mutually assured destruction on Monday. Can anyone recap what mutually assured destruction means? All right. Actually, I want two volunteers. Can I have two people out here? This will be much more fun. There you go. You two right here, because you're close.
Intercontinental ballistic missile, intercontinental ballistic missile.
Throw them at each other. That's mutually assured destruction. Thank you very much.
Round of applause for our two volunteers.
That condition exists or existed between the Soviet Union and the United States because they had roughly equal parity between their nuclear capabilities. Now, that parity doesn't exist between the United States and North Korea, even today. So, the United States could turn North Korea into a car park, as my colleague Michael O'Keefe said in a presentation last week. North Korea does not have the capacity to visit that kind of destruction on the United States. So there's not mutually assured destruction. But what the North Korean nuclear program does give the Kim regime the ability to do is to raise the political cost of the Americans taking military action against the North. And they can do this by threatening to target military targets in South Korea and Japan. So the Americans would win in a conflict, but at a potential cost that raises the political stakes of war to such a degree that it's just politically not feasible to do so. So that's the strategic rationale as far as deterrence goes for North Korea having nuclear weapons. Now there's another reason, another strategic reason that North Korea might want them. And there is some evidence that the North has incorporated nukes into an offensive war strategy. Now, whether they'd actually carry this out, that's a matter for debate. But what I think is reasonably clear is if the North did decide to attack the South, they do so not by a full frontal attack across the DMZ, because they'd get annihilated, but they do so by using asymmetric capabilities. And this is a picture of military exercises that took place last month in North Korea. So they would do things like insert special forces units into South Korea below the DMZ, behind enemy lines, if you like, to try and take out key strategic targets in the south. And that would be military bases, that would be important resupply depots, important infrastructure that would be key to any war effort. You could see missile and nuclear capabilities might be useful in that regard. Taking out key strategic targets in the south taking out key American strategic targets in Japan, with the goal that the North, once they'd done this, the North would then inject mass ground forces to try and take the peninsula quickly before the American military could resupply their forces in Korea. And by taking out targets in Japan, that would limit the Americans' ability to come and save the day. But this, after war, and this is more conjectural than the deterrence theory. All right, any questions on that? This is the strategic dimension. Okay. So the second major question that then arises is, North Korea now has nuclear weapons. They've successfully tested two nuclear devices. The first test was unsuccessful. But what these tests have demonstrated is that they're almost there, that very close to having the ability to deploy a nuclear weapon on a missile so that it can be a deployable deterrent. So for all intents and purposes, they've got nukes. Will they give them up? Now, there's been two decades of diplomacy with the international community trying to get North Korea to give up its nuclear program, offering all kinds of carrots and sticks to try and get the North Koreans to give up parts or all of its nuclear capability. My argument, and this is a pretty common argument now, is that no suite of carrots and sticks will be sufficient to tempt the North Koreans into giving up their nuclear program. And let's explore why. The North, ever since the late 1990s, has had a very unique political and economic system called Songun politics, or military first politics. Now, what do you see here? Who's Kim Jong-il in top left and Kim Jong-un in the other photos? Who's he hanging out with in these photos? The military. Why the military? If you're a dictator, why does it pay to have the military as your best friend? Any ideas? The military is the only institution of state capable of removing you. Conversely, if you're trying to maintain a totalitarian regime where you're exercising almost total control over the population, or attempting to at least, you need the military to exercise this kind of power. You need them on side. Now, in the mid-1990s, North Korea was on the verge of economic collapse. It had been heavily reliant on its ally, the Soviet Union, importing food, importing all kinds of manufactured goods, fertilizers, energy, importantly. 1991, Soviet Union collapses. All of these inputs that North Korea had sourced from the communist bloc stopped, came to a halt. So this put the North Korean economy into a tailspin. It's almost a failed state. Kim Jong-il's response to this dire situation is to elevate the military to the primary institution of the North Korean state. The Songun model gives the military primary access to all of the resources of the state. So the North Korean military now is effectively in charge of the North Korean economy. That's not how it was prior to 1991. That's the system that was put in place, and that's the system essentially as it exists today. But because there's still all of these missing inputs into the economy, these holes haven't been plugged. And so the nuclear program over the last 20 years has been very important in attempting to plug some of these holes, and I'll show you how. So possessing nuclear weapons gives the country international prestige. It gives the country more diplomatic clout than it otherwise would have if it didn't have nuclear weapons. Now, why might that be the case, do you think? Who would pay attention to an almost failing North Korea if it didn't have nuclear weapons? No one, that's right. Who pays attention to an almost failing North Korea with nuclear weapons? Everyone, right. Now, part of the reason for that is no one in Northeast Asia wants the North Korean state to collapse. For the Chinese, they're concerned that if North Korea collapses or if there's a war, that they'll have hundreds of thousands or even millions of North Korean refugees flooding across the border into the northeastern provinces of China. Now, these are areas of China that are not quite as well developed as the booming coastal fringes. These are areas of China that are ethnically diverse, and there are contested territorial claims there. So this is not a place where you want a massive refugee influx because it's likely to cause all kinds of social and political problems. So that's a doomsday scenario for the Chinese government. So they will prop up the North Korean government pretty much through thick and thin to prevent this outcome from coming to pass. And also, as the Korean War is an example, the Chinese do not want American troops on the frontier, looking at them across the Yalu and Chuman rivers. Mao Zedong intervened in the Korean War precisely to prevent this kind of scenario from coming to pass in the 1950s. And this still remains, this idea of preserving North Korea as a buffer zone against American forces still remains an important strategic priority for Beijing. So what this means is that everyone is invested in preventing North Korea from failing. So that gives North Korea a whole lot of bargaining leverage that it otherwise might not have. And when you insert nuclear weapons into the picture, that raises that bargaining leverage even more. And when you have bargaining leverage, it means you can extract concessions from the international community. And this is one of the means that the North Koreans have used to plug holes in their economy. Now, these two pictures, I took these last year. This is a fertilizer factory in Hamhung, which is on the east coast of North Korea. This is one of their best factories. This is one they're showing off to foreigners. Now, look at it. Look at the technology involved here. This is 1950s Soviet-era technology. It's being held together with Band-Aids, pretty much, because the companies that manufactured, or the entities that manufactured spare parts for these facilities don't exist anymore in the Soviet Union. So incredibly inefficient, and sorry, did someone say something? No, incredibly inefficient, and really emblematic of where North Korea's economy is at in terms of development. Also, here we have the North Korean tractor. Because of the energy shortages that still plague the country, you can't run wholesale mechanized agriculture. So here, a lot of farming's done with tractors and heavy machinery that run on oil. If you don't have any oil and you can't access it from international markets, then agriculture becomes very labour-intensive. So when you're driving through the countryside in North Korea, you see something strange for the Australian observer, is that there's lots of people in the countryside, on the side of the road, in the fields, because they're doing lots of this labour by hand or using draft animals. Because they just don't have enough energy to use mechanised agriculture. And again, this, I'm sure many of you will have seen this graphic, the famous satellite picture of North Korea and Northeast Asia at night time. So what do you notice about the north? It is dark. So this is what happens when you have energy shortages. This is a great illustration of that. Now, nuclear weapons, how is that important here? Through the six-party talks process, the North Korean government has done something called coercive bargaining, which is where they engineer a crisis event. So they might do a missile test. They might ramp up the rhetoric like they've been doing recently. They might threaten to restart a nuclear reactor, or they'll threaten to start reprocessing nuclear fuel from that reactor. something like that. They'll engineer a crisis event and then say to the international community, we'll pull back from this crisis if you give us something in return. And that something will be some kind of input, some kind of economic input. So that could be a large shipment of oil. So remember, North Korea doesn't have any indigenous oil reserves of its own. So it's desperately in need of oil. This is a good way to get oil, through coercive bargaining. This is a country that has a permanent food deficit. It's a mountainous country that doesn't have much arable land. It can't grow enough food for itself, so it has to import. But because of the state of its economy, it doesn't sell anything that international buyers would want, so it can't generate income to purchase food on international markets. So if you can't access food markets like that, coercive bargaining, leveraging the nuclear threat, is a good way to get aid shipments of food from the international community. So they've done that. Or fertiliser. Or direct cash injections. So what we've seen is that the North Korean government has been very efficient in leveraging the nuclear program to obtain these inputs that it needs for its economy, to maintain this unique Songun system. Another reason the North Korean government will not relinquish its nuclear weapons is because it has propaganda value, it has ideological value. Now, look at these pictures. This one is a photo that's out the front of the Sinchon War Museum in the town of Sinchon, just south of Pyongyang. The reason they take us or take foreigners there is because this was the scene of a massacre during the Korean War. And now the North Koreans blame the Americans for perpetrating this massacre. Hundreds of people died, and it did take place. There was a massacre there. But the best scholarly evidence suggests that it was the South Koreans that carried this out. But there's not as much propaganda value in blaming the South Koreans. They blame the Americans. And you can see a consistent theme through North Korean propaganda is anti-Americanism or anti-imperialism. And again, why is this important? We go back to the 1990s. Prior ideological paradigms about self-reliance and the primacy of the Korean Workers' Party started to lose their power as legitimating ideas for the government when the state started to collapse during the famine. The only idea that really remained standing at this time was anti-Americanism. So anti-Americanism continues to be really the peak justifying idea underpinning the domestic legitimacy of the Kim regime. So how do you think nuclear weapons might fit into that? America's put yourself in the position of the North Korean government. You're saying the Americans are our primary enemy. They're poised to attack us. So the government is saying to the people, you need us to defend you from the Americans. We have developed this modern, technologically sophisticated nuclear weapons program as the ultimate expression of our will to defend you from the American menace. So it's very clear that the link here, the ideological and propaganda value here, is very obvious of how the nuclear program fits in there. Now, does anyone here study economics or business studies or anything like that? I pity you, I really do. But your expertise is very valuable here. So have you ever heard of something called the sunk cost effect? Yeah. Sunk costs means that a company or a government or an entity has made large prior investments in something. So in this case, the North Korean government has invested heavily in developing this nuclear weapons program. So if you've expended all this treasure all this manpower in developing a sophisticated program? Are you just going to give it up? No. And it's arguable that no, even with a suite of incentives offered by the international community, that wouldn't be enough to make up for the prior, all of the accumulated prior investment that you've put into developing this program in the first place. So, and you'll see this in economies all around the world. Once a sophisticated project gets underway and is deep in development, it's extremely difficult to shut it down. It gathers a momentum, an institutional momentum. And it's difficult and sometimes impossible to claw that back. So even if the Kim regime thought, let's give up the nukes, it's not really making strategic sense, they will probably balk at giving it up in the end because they've invested so heavily in setting it up in the first place. Now, this is the Yongbyon nuclear facility. This is really ground zero of the North Korean nuclear program. They did have a reactor here, although they blew up the cooling tower of this reactor. So the cooling tower at a nuclear power plant, you know, everyone's seen The Simpsons and seen the big round conical-shaped chimney, if you like. That's a cooling tower at a nuclear site. So the North Korean government, as a gesture of goodwill in the to and fro of the six-party talks, destroyed it. So if you don't have a cooling tower, you risk, when you're doing a nuclear reaction, overheating the whole thing. So it effectively shuts it down. Now, little did the international community know at this time that the North Koreans had an underground, clandestine, highly enriched uranium program. And with highly enriched uranium, I won't bore you with the science, but you can produce nuclear fuel without having to run it through a reactor. So this was superfluous. But what you see in this map is that there's facilities all around the country. So if we're talking about prior investment, we're talking about production facilities, mine sites, reprocessing, scientific expertise that's located all around the country. Again, lots of sunk costs, very difficult to claw back. Now, one of the problems if you try and claw back a large technical program like this, especially in North Korea, is that you've got all this scientific and technical expertise that's been built up in the development of this program. Now, if you're a rocket scientist or a nuclear physicist working in this program and it's shut down, what are your alternative job prospects like in North Korea, do you think? Slim. There's nothing else. There's no other means that they'd be employed. So if you're a rocket scientist or a nuclear technician, how might you adapt to unemployment? Well, you'd probably try and flee the country. And that would be the CIA's wet dream, to have these people coming into South Korea and sharing all of their immense knowledge base about this program, including where all these clandestine sites are located, because then they could be targeted and destroyed. So if you're the North Korean government, you want to keep this program going so that these people will stay employed and stay put and you can utilise their expertise. If you shut it down, these people go. Or these people sell nuclear materials to third parties, to other countries, and that's dangerous for everyone. Okay, so to wind up then, let's recap. There's important strategic reasons underpinning North Korea's choice to develop nuclear weapons. And there's important diplomatic reasons related to international prestige, economic reasons related to plugging holes in their decrepit economy, domestic political reasons related to the legitimation of the leadership, and the effect of sunk costs, all of which are helping the North Korean government to, or prompting the North Korean government to maintain their nuclear weapons program. So we've got about 10 minutes left now, and I've never done a presentation on North Korea that hasn't elicited a storm of questions because it's such an interesting country. So I'm hoping that you can fire some at me now.
You said that everyone
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The rhetoric from South Korea is that they would like to reunify the country based on the South Korean model. But let's think about, in practice, what that actually means. The cost of reunification is estimated in the trillions of dollars. So, and why is that? Has anyone been to South Korea here? Yeah, so what was that society like? Yeah. Did you see people walking around with oxen in the street? You didn't see people cruising around with oxen or power blackouts or anything. No. So there's a massive discrepancy between the development level of South Korea and the development level of the North Korea. So if the South were to reclaim the North, the cost of actually bringing the North onto par with the South would just be immensely costly. Then you've got the cost of retraining all of the North Koreans, the cost of setting up education facilities, the cost of dealing with the trauma and health issues of people that have been living in a society like North Korea, where health outcomes, and especially mental health outcomes, are pretty bad. So,
resources in the North, would that
offset something? Well, they do have some. For a start, they've got uranium, which is why they can run their own nuclear fuel cycle. They've got rare earths. They've got lots of coal, which they export. All of these they export through China. But they don't have any oil, and South Korea doesn't have any oil. So that would add to the cost. You have to import energy sources to kickstart the industrialisation of the North. Yeah, up there. Well, people have been backing in the collapse of North Korea since 1991, and they consistently prove wrong. North Korea has been very adept at muddling through, despite the fact that it's clearly a weak state. But the regime's effectively coup-proofed itself, and using the nuclear program very adeptly to prop up the state in the ways that I've just described. And it looks like now, under the new leader, Kim Jong-un, that they're starting to accelerate. They've got a plan for not just bumbling through like they have been, but starting to modernise the country. So my theory is that they want to develop the nuclear program to its maturity, so they've got a deployable nuclear deterrent. So from their perspective, their external security is safe, and then they can start thinking about making modifications to their economy. So I don't mean reforms like neoliberal economic reforms that are talked about in the West, but it's just starting to tinker to make changes to make their system more efficient. So I don't think there's going to be change in the near future. Yeah, the back.
Is there any danger of revolution within North Korea that people are
No, I don't think so. It's a good question, one that people be asking regularly. So you look at like the Arab Spring scenarios. And people argue about what's underpinning the revolts that were happening there. But things that you had an active public sphere. So you've got people debating alternatives. People have the ability to meet together and organise. So you've got alternative political entities. Even if they're not directly involved in the process, people are organised politically. In North Korea, society is completely atomised. So it's really hard for even two people just to get together and have a chat about something. The internal repressive apparatus makes it difficult for people to organise for anything, for any reason. So it's really hard to get that together. Also, we look at the Arab Spring. One of the aggravations was that you had a whole middle class that had lost their position in society because of changes to the economy that had taken place over the last 20 years or so. Clearly that hasn't happened in North Korea yet. They've got an enormous bureaucracy. But let's say they did pursue the same kind of economic reforms that happened in, say, Egypt, which hollowed out the bureaucracy in that country. Hollowing out the bureaucracy in North Korea might create a whole class of people who've lost their position in society, and then they might start to get really angry about that and start to agitate. But that hasn't happened in the North yet. So until you see something like that, and until there's a space for people to organise politically, it's probably unlikely that there'll be a revolt there. Do you have a question before? No way. No. And when you're a foreigner going in, you have to go on a tour that's chaperoned by tour guides from the government. And when I say tour guides, I mean intelligence operatives that also know a lot about the sites that they're taking you to. So the people on our bus, we had about 20 people in our tour. We had 3 to 4 government guides or minders with us all the time. Now, at the end of each day, they go off somewhere. Now, the story goes that they go off to meet their minders in the intelligence service and report back on us. So they're data mining from us, if you like. But they also go and report on each other to make sure that none of them have become polluted by the foreigners, if you like, and become a threat. So that's an example of the coercive apparatus working to keep out ideas that might be troubling to the government. But it's also illegal for ordinary people to talk to foreigners. So what you see, it's like you're travelling around in a bubble. And you can see people far away, but around you, they're not around. And they, like if you even go and talk to them. Generally, no. I mean, sometimes you have an interaction, but they have to report back to their superiors if they have an interaction. So you can get them in trouble by trying to engage. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So if you look at, this is a country whose economy has effectively collapsed. So if you want to trade internationally, you've got to have something that international buyers want. Manufactured goods or value-added goods are usually the best way to earn foreign income. But North Korea's industry is really decrepit now, so they don't sell any value-added goods. They do have some natural resources that they're through mining that they're starting to sell, and there's some new wealth being generated, particularly in Pyongyang at the moment, that's being funded by selling raw materials, and that's been ramped up in the last few years. And also, they've got a unique economic system where they don't necessarily want to be exposed to the international economy. So they'd probably be looking at the global financial crisis and thinking, lucky we weren't exposed to that. We'd be in trouble. But, by happenstance and by choice, they're not connected to the international economy. Any other questions? Yeah.
How do you think America can go about achieving its interests in Korea?
Well, it's the American interests have been for the last 20 years to denuclearise North Korea, to get them to relinquish their nuclear program. And they haven't been able to do that. North Korea's effectively got a deployable weapon now. So they're going to have to find a way to manage a nuclear North Korea and save face. But if they try and keep insisting on North Korea giving up its nuclear program, it only makes the Americans look weak. And it sort of exposes their Asia pivot as something superficial. Now, I should explain the reason why they can't use military options in Korea. Has anyone seen a map of the Korean Peninsula? You look at where the South Korean capital city, Seoul, is. It's only 40 kilometres away from the border, from the DMZ. And on the other side of that border, the North Koreans have hundreds or thousands of short-range rockets and artillery pieces aimed at the South Korean capital, which they could destroy with only about 3 minutes warning if they wanted to. So for the Americans to be aggressive with the North, it would be playing Russian roulette with their South Korean allies. So that effectively takes military options off the table. So you can't talk tough with the North. It only makes you look weak. And that's a big constraint for Washington. Yeah. Well, it's a good example of developing something indigenously and preserving your system, isn't it? Now, for those that don't know, Juche is an ideology of self-reliance that was developed in the 1950s and has sort of evolved more or less since then. for various reasons. It was developed at a time when the North Koreans were playing off the Soviets and the Chinese, and they developed this ideology of self-reliance so that they wouldn't have to become beholden or rely on any one of their allies, so that they could play them off against each other. So fast forward to today, and the nuclear program really is a great expression of Juche. It says, we developed this, we're preserving our system. This is an example of Juche in action. Yeah, well, the new president, Park Geun-hye, she's the daughter of Park Chung-hee, who was a dictator of South Korea for 40 years. But her predecessor, Im Jung-bak, had something called the reciprocity policy. He said, we're not going to engage with the North unless they give something back to us, which effectively meant end of engagement. That was a failure, and that's partially one of the reasons why we're seeing North Korea ramp it up now.